On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, we are talking about Hamilton's LRT. Is it shovel ready? Well, that depends on how you define shovel ready. We'll talk about that one. We are also going to be talking about, is Canada corrupt? That is a loaded statement, isn't it? Because of course we're not corrupt. Well, you're probably right. But there is a corruption index that a group around the world looks at. We're going to tell you how Canada did on that index. And we're going to talk about Olympic television, because you may have noticed less publicity about the Olympics that start in just a few days. Why is that? Well, we'll try and explain that as well. Stick around.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
We have an election coming up in about five months. And that's a municipal, that's a provincial election. Then in 9 months, almost 10 months, we have a municipal election. And in that second one, I did not think that LRT possibly would be back on the discussion block. But then there was a story that came out today, and I started to wonder a little bit. And headline of the story in the spec from Matthew Van Donchen today, Hamilton's, quote, shovel-ready LRT, still 2 years away from major construction. That's going to surprise a few people, I think, who thought after the discussion and decision at City Hall back in late summer that we were like ready to get going. But again, this could mean that when the election rolls around, we are talking somehow, implausibly, somehow LRT again. Someone who has announced recently that he is going to be seeking election as mayor of the city of Hamilton and an LRT supporter, unapologetic about that, has been very supportive from the very beginning, I think, is Keenan Loomis, who joins us now. Keenan, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
I really appreciate you coming on here. I was wondering when you did think about and start deciding whether you were going to run for mayor, if you thought maybe the LRT was in the rearview mirror and we'd be talking about other things and this would not have to be on the agenda again, but this looks like the thing we can never get rid of.
Well, yeah, we have been discussing this for a very long time, and it might seem interminable, but there are so many other issues as well to discuss, and I do not think that this election will be another LRT referendum.
Let us hope. So when I hear the term shovel-ready, as a layperson, not as a contractor, not as a politician, not as whomever, my interpretation of shovel ready means, you know what, we're very close to being able to start working on this. The money's there, the permits are there, let's get going. It sounds like when you hear the people from Metrolinx talking, shovel ready really means it could be within a few years. What's your definition, or what do you hear when you hear shovel ready?
Well, shovel ready on a very complex project is something very different than going out and digging a hole in your backyard. Obviously, there are so many things that need to come into place, and we have to remember that the MOU between the Ministry of Transportation and the city was signed just last September. And this is moving at the speed of government, unfortunately. But when it comes time to building this, we will be ready. Obviously, there's so many different phases to this. And one of the interesting things that is happening is Metrolinx is trying to envision a different type of a path for this particular project. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, we don't really truly know what's underneath the street along the route. As we know, this is a very historic city. Lots of layers upon layers have been built up to create this city. And so I think that what they're trying to do is mitigate the impacts. And that will be good from a budgetary perspective and good from a business perspective as well, because, the last thing we want is for the street in front of a particular business to be open for a year to 18 months. If they go through, they understand what's underneath the street, they do the utility work first, and then in the second sweep, they basically do what would be a road resurfacing project. That will, again, mitigate the impacts to the costs that we are expected to incur, and, of course, the impacts to the businesses along the route as well.
And you know, one of the real reasons, one of the biggest reasons I wanted to have you on today is to talk about costs. Because again, if we're now talking that they're saying that we're going to be putting out the tenders or the contract offers not till next summer, and then, you know, building further out from that, and we see what's been happening with inflation, we see what's been happening with costs for everything. Do you believe that the final cost of this is still going to come in at $3.4 billion?
Well, I have to believe that. I mean, I'm not the expert here when it comes to this. I'm not a procurement expert. And I think that, you know, we're seeing costs coming down from the pandemic highs on a whole host of materials. So I think that, you know, things are going to settle down. We are going to get out of this pandemic. Supply chains will get back to normal. So maybe it's better to be doing this next year as opposed to right now in the middle of the pandemic. But again, that's not my expertise. What we need to be focused on, certainly as a Chamber of Commerce, is the business supports. And we're working on that with Metrolinx. So the time here, you know, it gives us the opportunity to be able to lay that groundwork, get expectations set, because that's exactly, you know, what we're going to need is to have the right attitudes going into this. And so if we understand very clearly what the schedule looks like and what the impacts are going to be for, you know, various points along the way, we'll be much better served.
And I understand, and I hope that you're right that the costs are going to go back down and everything, but what if they don't? And this is, I mean, as mayor, one of the things we've heard from the current mayor from the very beginning of this is the city of Hamilton will not be on the hook for a dime of construction or capital for this. We'll pay operating costs, but not to build it. What if they don't go back down? What if suddenly there's another 100 or 200 or more million dollars because of just inflation or whatever else that gets strapped onto this? Who covers that, or do we know yet?
That's all on the province and all on the federal government. That's why this is a good deal for local taxpayers. So, you know, they have they've taken on that risk. It's in the MOU, and they're the ones that with the deeper pockets that are able to cover those costs.
So we would not be, as a city, we would not be on the hook for any of this, even if cost overruns came in?
If you look at the MOU, it states that pretty clearly.
Okay. All right. Back to the idea then of this, if we, when we get, and I was sort of halfway joking when I started at the beginning about not having to fight the battle in the election, but if this is still out, if we're still not having construction going on, do you not see this? Because I mean, I don't know. It seems almost inevitable that this becomes an election issue. I'm not even sure how. But it seems almost inevitable that this becomes an election issue until it's actually happening.
Well, it won't be me that's making this an election issue. I don't know what the media is going to do, and I don't know what various candidates are going to do, but it's not going to be me. And I think that, you know, if somebody were to make this an election issue, they're probably not reading the room right, because I've heard from so many people who were not in support of this. But now they just want to get on with this, and they're resigned to the fact that this is going to happen, and in fact have come around and understand all the various benefits to it. So, and especially, it would be really hard to turn down an investment like this in our city, $3.4 billion, and all the other ancillary benefits that come with it, and long-term investment. It would be absolutely deflating, and it would injure our image. And no level of government would want to work with us ever again. So the impacts would be absolutely devastating to our community. And instead, you know, it's time to focus on transit as a whole. And, you know, there are so many exciting things happening at West Harbor. Last year, the A-Line investments were announced, and other investments to our transit system. And it's all part of a very broad transit improvement plan that will modernize our local fleet and our regional connections as well. So I don't understand why any person would choose this one very narrow issue on top of all the other things that are happening and the challenges that we face. This would not be a winning campaign as far as I'm concerned.
Last thing, do you see this as possibly, I mean, again, when the initial reaction to hearing that this is still a couple of years off from really getting going, the initial reaction might be a negative. Do you see it as a positive, perhaps, that it buys people more time to figure out what they're going to do as far as development and other things along the line?
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly the case. And when it comes to the businesses, what they want is certainty. And so to be able to see when it's going to happen and for us to communicate that clearly and for them to be able to devise plans to be able to survive those impacts, that's how they're going to do it. And so it doesn't matter if it starts tomorrow or 2 years from now. If we know and understand the plan clearly, we will be able to survive it. I think that, you know, the one thing is that people in the city have confidence that it's going to happen. And you see the investments and the cranes in the air are testament to this. Exactly, what this investment has been able to unlock. We're seeing it right now. And so all we need to know is it's happening. When it comes time to the actual calendar, that's one thing. Right now, we have confidence in downtown Hamilton because we know that the upper levels of government are investing in this. All three parties on both of those levels of government are supporting this project. So really, there's no doubt that this is going forward.
Mayoral candidate Keenan Loomis, really appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this tonight.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
There is a global organization that looks at how countries around the world are doing as it pertains to corruption. It's called Transparency International. And every year it does a report on how countries are doing as far as cleaning up corruption and governing in a way that's ethical and, as per its name, transparent. So how is Canada doing? Well, not badly. If you look at where we stand in the world rankings, according to the report from this year, we are 13th out of 180, which actually sounds pretty darn good. I think in most cases, if we could be 13th out of 180, we would take that. That is a very positive thing. On the other hand, if you look at the trend over the last number of years in this country, it's a little less optimistic because we have been sliding. We've dropped 8 spots in the past 5 years, and our grading score is falling faster than any other country on that list. James Cohen is the executive director of Transparency International Canada. He joins me now. James, thanks for doing this today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it, Scott.
So I'm reading this. I'm looking over this report. I can't say I've read every country's rundown. I didn't have time to get through all 180 today in depth. But how do you measure this stuff? How do we measure corruption?
Yeah, so there's a number of ways you can measure corruption, and the Corruption Perception Index, the methodology is that there are 13 trusted sources that Transparency uses, so organizations like the World Economic Forum, the Economist Intelligence Unit, things like that, and for any country to be listed on the CPI, you need at least 3 sources. Canada in 2021 had 8 sources. So our team in Berlin, that's where our secretariat is, they've got the methodology to compile the scoring from those sources and bring us the score of each country.
And for us to be dropping, according to the report, dropping faster than anyone else, what are we doing wrong?
Well, the interesting thing is that there's no kind of key scandal that led to this drop. So Canada fell out of the top 10 least corrupt countries back in 2019. And at that point, it was kind of obvious that we fell out because of things like Canada's money laundering problem had become a national headline. And in 2019, Canada had gone through the political fallout of the SNC-Lavalin scandal. So those really kind of caught everyone's attention saying, well, yeah, of course we dropped. What we saw from the data this time around is that it's a bit of a ripple effect. The idea that different international observers who, compile our rule of law, our ease of doing business, things like that, are still noticing that these issues have happened, but there's not really a counterbalance. We haven't really done enough to correct course to make us kind of stop losing points on the score or finally start reversing the tide and gain our place back in the top 10.
Because one of the things is the word corrupt, I mean, it is, I think you would acknowledge, it is a really, it's a heavy word, and we hear corruption, And we think about banana republics or dictatorships or regimes. Corrupt is a really strong word, is it not, to apply to Canada in any way?
Yeah, nobody likes being accused of corrupt. I mean, I've been on delegation in Burundi and East Africa where we talked to police officers about corruption, and they didn't like being accused of being corrupt more than the Kenyan police officers. It's a dirty word that nobody likes, but it's important to recognize that even a country like Canada, where we tend to think of ourselves as, you know, a good global actor, kind of squeaky clean, we have our challenges. Now, as you said at the beginning, we're 13th out of 180. It's not like we're a banana republic, as some might say, but we've got problems. We've had ethics issues at the federal government level that have ensnared headlines. We have really weak anti-money laundering laws in this country that allow dirty money from around the world to pool in and even recycle itself here in Canada. So we do have problems.
The report, again, as I'm looking at it here, is CPI. It's called the Corruption Perceptions Index. And, you know, it caught me. I missed it the first or second time as I read that. It's not the Corruption Index. It's the Corruption Perceptions Index. So is this real corruption, or is this how, by the name, it's how people perceive the country to be doing?
Yeah, correct. So as you said, there's a number of ways to measure corruption. This is just one of them. And it is a perception. It is based on those 13 trusted sources that have their own scoring mechanisms. So whether it's from an angle of our rule of law, our access to information, our whistleblower protection, our ease of doing business without corruption or bribery, there's a number of perspectives that come into this. The thing about measuring corruption is very difficult by its very nature. Even if you had one specific case, it's tough to say we have more cases or less cases than another country. So there are, say, measures that Transparency International does where they do, or we do, poll people about their experiences in paying bribes. That hasn't been done in Canada since 2013, but that's another way of measuring corruption.
And the perception part, I mean, look, I'm not dismissing what you're doing in any stretch. I'm having you on here because I find it fascinating, but I wonder, does all this matter? Because even as I'm asking this, even as we're talking about this, we are just in the wake a few months ago of our federal government being rewarded with a new term of office, and they are the ones who presumably have been the ones at the center of what your report is finding. So it seems to me that many people in this country can't think it's that serious, or we wouldn't have reelected them.
Well, Rivera, it's a minority government, the second one in a row. I would say, you know, I get comments from people from all sides, either saying Canada's not that bad, or Canada should have scored way worse. We are actually, if you dig down, we're the most corrupt country in the world, which I personally don't find. I think it's somewhere, I think Canada ranking 13th is emblematic of where we stand. We do have a number of good structures in place in Canada, but we have problems. This government started off as a majority. It's fallen into two minority governments. Ethics, anti-money laundering, these issues were at the top of political platforms for all parties, including the Liberal Party. So everyone's had to acknowledge some of the challenges that have gone on in this country.
Just before we go here, I also wonder if what ends up happening is, like so many other things, everything in the world, everything in our country is so politicized that if you are a fan of the current government, you simply say, look, a list like this is just out to get them and it's overbearing. And if you are not a fan of the current government, you say, look how horrible they are and it should be worse. It seems as though everything now is so, we have such polar opinions that it's probably really hard to get agreement on whether your list says what it's supposed to say or not.
Yeah, true. I mean, the word corruption, as you said before, it's a dirty word. Nobody likes it. And it can be hurled around quite easily. There, as I said, people have already commented. I've received emails and so forth saying, no, thanks for seeing that Canada drop, but we're actually way worse. I take that with a grain of salt, or I take it as, you know, some people do experience other issues that maybe the CPI didn't grab. But again, even, you know, the Liberal Party, if we look at the issue of anti-money laundering, That's one of the reasons we fell down in the rankings. Prime Minister Trudeau acknowledged Canada's anti-money laundering weaknesses back in 2019 at a press conference. And the Liberal government has, to their credit, done some things to address the issue. The problem is they just haven't come into effect for quite a while. We're not seeing it. And then even all the other federal parties during the election, they had an anti-money laundering platform as well. So even the Liberal government that's, you know, overseen this fall in the CPI, they have had reactions to try and address some of the issues that have come up that have caused us to fall.
James Cohen from Transparency International Canada, thanks for doing this. Appreciate the time.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
For the record, as we go here, number one tied, three countries tied in the world for most transparent, least corrupt, according to this, Denmark, Finland, and New Zealand. And way down at the other end of the spectrum, the country perceived to be most corrupt, according to this, South Sudan, down at number 180.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
The Olympics open, first competitions are Wednesday, opening ceremonies next Friday. We're not far away, a week, basically. And I'm guessing, though, if you are typical of most people, you have probably not really caught the Olympic fever yet. Maybe some of you have. But it's pretty hard to catch something when there's not much of the bug around. And what I mean by that, have you seen many ads for the Olympics on TV like we normally would leading up to this? And I don't just mean the ads for, hey, tune in to NBC or tune in to CBC or tune in to CTV. I mean companies jumping on board and advertising. It seems that there's a whole lot less of them this time than in usual days. Bill Briou is the guy behind Briou TV, great TV writer. He joins us now. Bill, how are you tonight?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic. I appreciate you doing this. But I will say, usually by the time we are a week out from an Olympics, we are just swimming in nonstop Olympic commercials. And I've seen some, and I know that NBC has the little rings logo on their screen all the time and everything now. But I got to tell you, like, it's, if you didn't know the Olympics were coming up, it's no guarantee that you would know the Olympics were coming up.
Well, you're right. It's been a lot quieter than in past years. Of course, in Canada, I think a lot of us get less interested when the NHL pulled out. You know, it's the Winter Games. These are our games, and normally that's got everybody's attention. So it's part of it here, but I think it's double-edged, too, with COVID, obviously. You know, there's everything has been curtailed. There's, you know, no people in the stands kind of things. We saw this with the Summer Games when they finally happened. And it just seemed to be subdued as an event in that way. And then, of course, you've got this threat of war breaking out in, you know, Russia. I mean, it's just so that there's a lot of distractions right now. And the Olympics are, I guess, on the back burner because of it.
Well, let me go through a few other things. And I want to know if you think any of this has anything to do with it, because it could be just that. And that's maybe enough. But there is the fact, I was wondering, that the Tokyo Games got delayed by a year, and so we're only really a year out from the Summer Games, and I'm wondering if you think there's any chance that we have Olympic fatigue somehow, because we just had an Olympics.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, and it hasn't even been a full year, because one, you know, summer to winter, it seems like we just had the Olympics. So I do think that a lot of people are probably less excited. You know, it used to be you'd have to wait 4 years for both the Winter and Summer Games. And now even 2 years hasn't really gone by. So, yeah, I think that's part of it. They just happen.
What about the time difference? Beijing is 13 hours ahead of us. So if there's a game that starts, say, or an event that starts at 1 PM there, it's 2 AM our time. I almost wonder if some of the networks have essentially said, you know what, let's see how this goes rather than throwing everything at this. Let's see if we get an audience for this. I mean, I on the one hand, I find it hard to believe that they're going to stand down and just let it happen as opposed to promoting the heck out of it, because they still have their primetime shows. But does time difference matter?
I think less and less in some ways. You know, Scott, the American network, NBC, they've kind of pretended that things are live when they decide they're live in prime time. Like for several games now, they just go ahead and run it and hope people don't look at their phone at any point during the day and find out who won. And they seem to still draw an audience for that approach. And here's an interesting thing. You know what the lowest rated winter games has been in the last 30 years?
I'm guessing you're going to say Vancouver for some reason.
It is. It's Vancouver. It was significantly down in the United States. It's a great question. I mean, they were phenomenally successful. The highest ratings ever in the history of Canadian television was in 2010 Vancouver Olympics. It was just, you know, that game that where Sidney Crosby scored, I think there was like 14, 15 million people watched that hockey game, maybe more. So it's curious. I don't know if it was because Canada did so well and the United States didn't, that the Americans were kind of turned off those games. But there's a case where the time zone was the same in the West Coast anyway, and the United States were watching other things.
And you're right. I mean, look, NBC it's been a bit of a running joke, although, look, they've done it successfully, that they rarely show things live and turn everything into a sob story. So, like, every Olympic athlete who's ever competed for the States is recovering from being hit by a truck and having malaria and dengue fever, and their mother had an amputation the week before the games. I mean, but it works. It's a formula that works for them.
It is, and it's all about the personalities and the biographies. You got Michaela Schifrin, the U.S. Olympic female skier and the ski team. There's a lot of focus there. So they will do the biographies and try to create new stars that they can promote. And I think, too, a lot of us are just cynical about the games until they finally start. And suddenly you find yourself catching a bit of Olympic fever again. So we'll see. Maybe there'll be enough stories that people tune back in.
And I expect that's probably the case. It still doesn't kind of, and I think you're right, but it still doesn't explain the lack of buildup to it. And I'm wondering if I go to possibility number three that I wrote down here as why this might seem to be the case. I'm wondering, and I think this may be closest to the truth, I wonder if this is simply the worst place and worst time right now for the Olympics to be. Because, I mean, China is not the world's darling right now. We've got the two Michaels and the Uyghurs and Taiwan and Hong Kong and rumors about the origins of COVID and everything else. And I just wonder if there is malaise is not the right word because it's stronger than that. And disdain may be too strong a word, but something in between towards China that people just don't feel excited about the place.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that, poor Japan, they went to all this trouble and they had to postpone their games a year and could not have fans in the stands and lost a lot of revenue. I don't think people would be that sad if China had to pause a year. You're right, because of headlines, COVID, whatever, there's just been a lot of negative impressions there. That could be it. I don't know. Like it's a great question, and I just think that the other part of it too, Scott, is that television has just changed. These big events, except for the Super Bowl, they're not the powerful audience magnets they once were. The Olympics has shown steady declines, just like the Oscars and other things, and that giant number isn't really as big as it used to be.
Although we saw last Sunday, it can be, because that Buffalo Bills Kansas City Chiefs game, 43 million people apparently, and that's just Americans, tuned in to watch, not counting Canadians. So if it's magical, it still can.
That game was the second highest TV audience, TV show, since the last Super Bowl. Like, it bigger than anything else that's happened in a year, and it is a phenomenal number. And those games were really exciting. That whole weekend, every game was decided by a walk-off field goal or overtime. So you could see why people gathered interest in it. And that performance by those two quarterbacks was crazy. So,
but it shows that sports can still do that. If the Olympics are compelling beyond belief, you could still have enormous numbers.
Yeah, and I bet in Canada, you know, here they're throwing together a ragtag team to represent. If they do okay, people are really going to be cheering for them. You know, like I think you always want to root for the underdog, and it's a little bit David and Goliath now. So there's stories for sure. I think part of it, too, maybe the networks were a little hesitant to get too ramped up with their promotions because they just didn't know, you know, this strain, the coronavirus.
That could be.
Were the Olympics going to be shut down and postponed again? You know, there was questions about it, even though China always indicated they would go on. But sometimes I don't think even the commentators are making the trip, that it's all being done by watching monitors and people commenting from Canada about the games, the CBC coverage at least.
Bill, there has also been, though, while the buildup to this is going on, and so we're talking about the networks and how much they're pushing this or not pushing it, but there's also the advertiser part of this.
Yeah.
And there's been a big push by various human rights groups to boycott the Olympics, which hasn't happened, or to have some sort of action against it, even to have the broadcast networks boycott it, which hasn't happened. But do you think that those groups could be having some success with advertisers where they're, if you're an advertiser, you don't want to look too excited about these Olympics because of the risk? You know, you have comments. There was a comment from one of the organizers that said, this is a quote, "Any behavior or speech that is against the Olympic spirit, especially against Chinese laws and regulations, is subject to punishment." I wonder if some of the advertisers are skittish about what could happen here, and do we want to be too closely aligned with this?
I don't know. I think advertisers, if they think that 20 million people will watch, they get over some of their scruples. But I hear what you're saying. I think that, you know, that there's all kinds of questions about that. We live in an age of cancel culture. People are very cautious now, and advertisers certainly at the top of that list. So, yeah, it could be that some of them are just not ready to go out on a limb this year.
You and I, or myself and others, will over the next few weeks be talking a lot about Olympics and Olympic sports. And so if people are saying, you guys are, I thought you were talking Olympics, this is pretty, pretty heavy, granted. And stick with us, because the next thing I'm going to ask you is even heavier. But there are predictions out there, and I don't know where they're coming from, but people can read them if they want, that Vladimir Putin will use the distraction of the Olympics to invade Ukraine, as you touched on at the top. Would that be a distraction, or would all the attention stick with the Olympics? What would happen if that happened? Do you think the eyes of the entire world would go there, or would they stay with the Olympics because it's a big, big sport that's being televised?
I think, and hearing some of the rumblings on news, on TV news channels, that it certainly would be seen as a distraction by China. And, you know, Putin is supposed to be an ally, and what the heck? You know, this is our big games. We want to present this flawless event, and you start a war? You know, so there's that side of it, too. It could be that, you know, and that's some of the commentary I've heard, that there is less likely for it to break out during the games, maybe right after, but that China would frown upon and be not look kindly to this happening during their big event.
So look in the closing ceremonies for an indication. I laugh not laughing, ha ha. It's not a funny thing at all, but boy, it is kind of insane that you would time a war for an Olympics. When you really think about it, I mean, that's just the height of what is going on in the world when we're considering a war anyway, but that we're not going to do it because there's an Olympics going on.
The world is obviously changing on many levels, and even in terms of generational watch, you know, I think my kids are, you know, my son's 29, Dan, Katie's 31 now, and I don't know if the Olympics are as, and it's hard to say, they get excited about this stuff too, but I don't know. I think that's NBC's concern, CBC's concern, that younger viewers are less enthused about the games. They might see it in a different way. They're not part of that flag-waving tradition, and they're a little more I just think that's part of it. That it's a demographic.
That could be. That is very much possibly it too. Listen, I'm sure we'll be talking about this because once it gets going, it is pretty much all encompassing. Unless you're watching Netflix, and maybe even they'll have Olympic stuff. Who knows what'll happen? Bill Brieu from Brieu TV. Always love having you on. Thanks for doing this, Bill.
My pleasure. At any time.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.